why y'all came to class today.
It's gonna be so simple.
Later.
My reason for the book, they're in trouble. Daniel 4 is a picture of, I titled Nebuchadnezzar's in our syllabus, Dream of the Great Tree. It's not particularly exciting, it's interesting, and it was not particularly, we're going to find this chapter easier going than some of the other chapters where we have some real difficult stuff to work through. But I want to get through the chapter today, maybe even more. Verses 1 through 3, we have a proclamation of Nebuchadnezzar. Now you recall, now exactly when this fits in, well, we'll get some of the details later. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth, may your peace abound. It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God, that's the God of Daniel, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation. Nebuchadnezzar is his proclamation. He's telling something of his experience. Now, what we're doing is we're looking at his experience, and then this is a flashback. It is after the fact. And then now he tells me, we're going to find out what brought him to this conclusion, that the Most High God has done great signs and that we ought to honor him. Again, Nebuchadnezzar does not say that Nebuchadnezzar is a monotheist. We must not read that in. He's simply honoring Daniel's God. I indicate here the question of biblical language being used by a pagan ruler. Did he actually say this? Perhaps Daniel worded the proclamation reflecting the sentiments of the king. We don't really know. It would not have been unusual. The king was or Daniel was very much in the middle of this thing. So now we're going to see what brought him to this kind of submission. Let me just teach you all something, just to give this sort of a context. And we've touched on this, but I don't think I have properly dealt with it. The message of Daniel, a primary message in the whole book, what the thing is about, if not the primary message, is that the God of Israel, the Most High God, is the God who causes kings to rise and kingdoms and causes them to fall for his own purposes. Now, that fact comes in conflict in the book of Daniel with the competing claims which are made on behalf of pagan gods, Marduk in particular, the god of Babylon, the chief god. That is, the pagan rulers, we're going to see this, whether it's Babylonian or Persian or Assyrian earlier, it's making a difference. And later on, much later, Roman, their belief was that their gods had made them great. And so the book of Daniel makes it very clear. As Daniel says, remember the last chapter, the vision of the great image, the four-part image, the four metals, that you think that your God put you up, made you great and Babylon great. Not so. God did it. Now, this, students, puts us at a crossroads. Either we are going to view history as a simple combination of chance, cause, and effect. Or we're going to view history the way it ought to be viewed, and that is as his story. Now, let me tell you how to look at history. I'm a historian, and I've had I remember one of the seminars we had at the university on historiography was whether there, we talked about the different views of history, the cyclical view of history in the past, also I think about the future. And how we struggle with with what we might call theologies of history, views of history. And I take the biblical view of history, which is a cute way of saying it is, it's his story. But it's more than a cute saying. Either we can view history the way with the secular mind. Now, of course, with Daniel, he was opposing the pagan mind. That is, the polytheistic paganism of his day. But there's more than one kind of paganism. Now, and the biblical view of history, which is the view that I teach, is that the most important event in the ancient world, that event, other than creation, that event, which is the pivot, is the point of reference, is what I want to say, for all other events, is the promise made to Abraham that the twofold promise in the beginning of the second millennium BC, that one would be born, that through Isaac he would have many descendants, and the second part of his twofold promise, that of his descendants would arise one, the Messiah, through whom all nations of the earth would be blessed. Now the law, as Paul says to the Galatians, was just added to the promise. And what history is about, before and after, but I'll just speak of after, because that's an easy way to think about it. We don't have a lot of time to go too deep into this. From then on, that's not really what I mean, because God worked before then, but that, what is going on in history is that God is keeping that promise. Jesus came to fulfill the law in a secondary way. Jesus came primarily to keep the promise. Now, and what we look at history, we look at the ancient Mesopotamian kingdoms before the first millennium BC. We look at those that arose in the millennium before Christ, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Hellenistic monarchies, the Roman Empire. God caused these empires to rise and to fall for the simple reason that they played a role in the keeping of that promise. That's why they came and went. And everything connected with that promise. I mean, it's very complicated. We could talk for hours about and guess, make a lot of speculating, which is sometimes worthwhile. But the point is, but as to what role they played in keeping, first the law played a role in keeping alive the knowledge of sin and the importance of the promise, the existence of the promise. And of course involved in the keeping of the promise was the preservation of God's people through whom the Messiah would come. And the creation of the vocabulary and the setting of history, so that when Paul could write, in the fullness of time, God sent forth his son, born of woman, born under the law. Now that is what is going on. And I'm convinced it's what's still going on. God did not go out of business in the first century. That if we do not understand that it is for the keeping of the promise, and all that's connected with the promise, all the implications of it. Well, it would take a long time to develop that, but that is what is going on here in our lesson. That is, we see very specifically why God raised up Babylon, and this is the point that God makes to Daniel makes to Nebuchadnezzar. Look, you think you're king of a great empire, great city. Not the empire wasn't all that big. Very wealthy, very powerful. You're the top dog. You're in the catbird seat now. And you think it's because you're three kinds of hot stuff. I'm paraphrasing. And because your God just thinks so much of you that he made you great. Let me tell you something. God, Daniel says it up to you. You are on the throne because my God put you there. He put you there for his reasons. And when he stood with you, your history. For that and no other reason. So you come off your high and mighty. And you better acknowledge who's really in charge here, because you're an absolute idiot if you think that you're there for any other reason than for the reasons my God has. Now, we know the reason, because in this case, we don't have to speculate, because the prophets tell us. God raised up Babylon to be the woodshed for his people because they needed to go to the woodshed, otherwise they were going to lose track of both the law and the promise. Y'all see that? And that's the only, that's why they existed. It was not chance. And the prophets, don't the prophets say that? Okay, you go to the woodshed, you take your spanking, learn your lesson. Why? So that God can keep the promise. This makes sense to you? Now this is what's going on. So what we're seeing here is a small, if we understand the book of Daniel in that larger context, I think it's going to make a whole lot more sense to us. And so, and listen to me. Apart, why was Israel or Judah in Babylonian captivity, the leaders of the nation? To learn a lesson that they ought not to make, they ought to stay away from idolatry. That was their primary sin. Did they learn that lesson? Well, they sure did. The days of Jesus, they wouldn't even let a coin in the temple with an image on it. A lot of lessons they did learn. They learned that one. Why did God allow the nation of Judah to be conquered? For the same reason he allowed Samaria, the northern kingdom, to be conquered. Because they had turned away from God and were going after idols. These false gods, which are no gods. That's why the prophets continually ridicule the pagan gods. You got to carry them around and feed them, and you made them in the first place. Our God's not made with human hands. You see the perfect example of that when on Mount Carmel, Elijah mocks Baal and the prophets of Baal. Just speak a little louder. Your God, wait, right? He's gone to lunch. And, he's covered his feet, which means what? He's in the John. That's why you can't hear it. He's got noise and thunder. Anyway, absolute ridicule. Well, now, if this is the purpose for the rise of Babylon, if this is what is going on, and God is using these nations for his purpose, and what is going on is he's keeping the promise, the messianic promise, then you see how it is important for these Jews, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who are in high places, and they are the leaders of the Jewish nation in captivity, the Jews in captivity, that the point is made more than once. We're going to see all through Daniel. I mean, it's hard to always locate this through the history of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. But time and again, and into the Persian Empire, the lesson is driven home at the highest levels. What lesson? The lesson, now hear me, the lesson that they were there to learn. What was that lesson? The gods of the Gentiles are no gods. Our God is the God, is the God of heaven. He's the one you fear. He's the one you trust. So, what I'm teaching you is that this battle that's going on between the gods of Babylon, Mesopotamian gods, and the God of Israel is a part of the lesson. School is in session. Because that's why Israel is there, or the Jews are there in the first place, to learn their lesson. Is this making sense to you? So we must not see this, as the liberals see it, as sort of an isolated myth. This is not an isolated myth. It's not a folk tale that's a nice little story, unconnected to anything else. Oh, no. While it sounds very unusual to us, being modern people and being Westerners, this kind of thing going on, these are ancient Orientals, and God deals with them as they are. And it's a part of the total, it fits right in what I'm saying. It's right in with what's going on, if we properly interpret history. So as a part of this learning process, that God might preserve a people so we can, as a part of his program of keeping the promise, we have this confrontation. And Nebuchadnezzar is very arrogant, you see. He's boasting. And you see, if I'm right about this, to make sure I have made my point, let me make it again. If I'm right about this, the primary reason this goes on, the immediate reason, understood in the light of the total context, the total program and purpose of God, the immediate reason this kind of thing goes on is to teach the Jews a lesson. It was for the Jews to learn what they were there to learn. Okay, any questions on that? I think if we look at it from this viewpoint, we will see it better. And so he's telling what brought him to this place of humble acknowledgement of the God, of the Most High God. I, Nebuchadnezzar, verses 4 through 18. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace. I love that. You see the language here. He's going to be represented by a tree. We're going to see a tree flourishing. I saw a dream, and it made me fearful. And these fantasies as I lay on my bed, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. Now, was this the original Nebuchadnezzar? Look what I say here. Possibly the same Nebuchadnezzar, but a successor using his throne name. We've already talked about this. It's difficult to tell.
Is it the same one that was with the fire return?
I say possibly, but not necessarily. You can't be sure. I saw a dream, so I gave orders to bring into my presence all the wise men of Babylon, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Now this suggests that it was not the original Nebuchadnezzar, because it just suggested it, because right away he was sent for Daniel. Or maybe not. He doesn't seem to be a fellow who learned lessons easily, and we don't know how much time has passed. There is some indication that it is the original Nebuchadnezzar, the first. I'll tell you what those are when we get to them. Hard to know. Then the magicians, the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners, this whole outfit we've met before came in, and I related the dream to them, but they could not make its interpretation known to me. Now note this. Is this a suggestion that it is or is not the Daniel, the Nebuchadnezzar, the first one who saw the enemy set up in the plain? Why?
Why would he bother these guys to
begin with? Yeah, something more specific than that.
Well, he told
Renee. Go ahead.
They meant to tell him the dream.
Yeah, he tells them what the dream is. Before, what did the first one do? He said, you tell me what the dream is. Now, that doesn't prove it, but that suggests it's not the same one. Finally, Daniel came in before me. Again, Daniel always has to be rounded up. He's never there. We don't know where his job took him, but Daniel is either, like the fiery furnace, isn't brought in at all, or he's brought in late. We're going to see this in the pattern. Whose name was Belteshazzar, his Babylonian name, according to the name of my God, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, that is in Daniel. See, he's still a pagan. Still a polytheist. And I related the dream to him, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, since I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and no mystery baffles you. And that suggests it is the original one. Doesn't it? Tell me the visions of my dream which I have seen along with this interpretation. Now here he asks Daniel to tell him the dream and the interpretation. By the way, I think it was the original one myself. I'll tell you why in a minute. Now these were the visions in my mind as I lay on my bed. I was looking, and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height of it was great. The tree grew large and became strong. Its height reached to the sky. It was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its foliage was beautiful, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, the birds of the sky dwelt in its branches, and all living creatures fed themselves from it. I was looking in the visions in my mind as I lay on the bed, behold, an angelic watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven, a commentator. He shouted and spoke as follows, chop down the tree and cut off its branches. Strip off its foliage and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it, and the birds from its branches. Yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and and bronze around it. If you don't know what it looked like, turn to the next last page. I drew it. I drew that. I want you to know. Let me go. I mean, I did part of that. The band was mine. So I knew the students were going to say, what did it look like? And that's what it looked like, because they were wondering. And that didn't come from divine revelation, but very close. I was artistically inspired tonight. Put a band around the stump, a band of iron bronze around it, and the new grass of the field. Let him be drenched. Note this, it's him now. Note the language. Obviously, this tree represents a person. Let him share with the beast and the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man. Let a beast's mind be given to him. Let seven periods of time pass over. And this sentence is by decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind. That is, that God is the ruler, not mine. And bestows it on whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men. This is the dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, tell me its interpretation, inasmuch as none of the wise men of my kingdom is able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able for the spirit of the holy gods that is in you. Now, so here he tells Daniel the dream. After he said to him, "You tell me the dream." Now, we don't know whether Daniel had already told him, and he's explaining it further. We don't know, but the point is that he sets the dream forth. Now let's look at some of the details. The liberals suggest this is Nabonidus, the last king of Babylon, because Nabonidus is known to have some kind of sickness, but that we'll come to that later, and I don't accept that. I just put that in so for the sake of completeness. 20 years from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar are not mentioned by Daniel if this is the Nebuchadnezzar who had the dream of the great image. That's one of the problems of chronology. But again, there's not good evidence for this contention. You can look at that. You can review that in the syllabus. If this is the original Nebuchadnezzar, he learned his lessons the hard way. Now, the fact that God had to reduce this man to the state of an animal may suggest that that's the very kind of man he was. Some people are like that. Some kids are like that. Some students are like that. Professors aren't, but students often are. I mean, do you ever know anybody had learned the same hard lesson over and over and over? Some people are very hard-headed. You think you're not? Let me ask you this. How many of you were determined last quarter, this quarter, you were going to start your term paper the first week? But you didn't. Why? Well, I've learned my lesson. I've heard students say that. Well, I've learned my lesson. And I always say, yeah, we'll see. 1 in 100.
I thought that if the magician and other enchanters and enchanters were told the dream, that they would make nothing about it. Of what it meant. But how come they...
Good question. He tells them the dream, but they couldn't interpret it. And why didn't they make one up? Well, this may suggest it's the original Nebuchadnezzar who had a built-in distrust of them. And maybe they said, well, he's not going to buy it. And they were afraid to. There seems to be a loss of confidence there. The system doesn't work the way it was supposed to work, the way it had worked before. It's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. We don't know all that went on. It may be that they feared that they would give an interpretation and Daniel would come and give one that would outvote it and they would be... Whatever. There does not seem to be the confidence that he had in before, and they don't seem to be willing to take a chance now, if it's the same bunch. Obviously, Daniel was brought in quicker to this. He was brought in right away. That is, notice when they... says, finally, Daniel came in before me. Apparently, they knew he was coming, or he's brought in. What I think happened was, if you want an opinion, I think he brought them in, and he said, I'm going to ask you guys, and Daniel's coming too, but he's out wherever he was. I'll take him a while to get here. You guys go ahead. Okay. You say Daniel's coming? We pass. I think that's what happened, not in those words. In other words, I think the reason he came in, he says, finally, Daniel came in. I think he's saying, finally, he finally got here. And I think that is why. Well, Daniel, okay, first of all, the whole picture, I think it's the original Nebuchadnezzar. And one of the reasons is that, I'll give another one later, but one of them is, that's how, if it is the original one, he sure learned his lesson the hard way and had to relearn it. But that's the very picture that you get that emerges in the chapter of a man who had to be taught the hard way. Now, Daniel may have held back waiting for center stage. He may have, made himself hard to find because he's teaching a lesson to his people. He wants to make it as pointed as possible. He may have just had, I've mentioned his absence before, indeed. Well, Nebuchadnezzar recounts his dream. Now, what is the significance? We've read that. What is the significance, the symbolic significance of the tree? between the middle of the earth. Babylon was regarded, now Babylon was regarded as the center of the earth. Just like, this is an interesting concept, which I'll just mention briefly and pass on. The ancients, we don't think in terms of the center of the earth. We think more in terms of the globe, though the ancients knew the world was round. But they didn't have the worldwide concept because they were more limited in their ability to travel and know. So they thought of the center of the world was where they were. Interestingly enough, if you go to, when we take you to the Holy Land, we'll take you to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And just a few, about 30 or 40 feet from the garden tomb, from the tomb that the there in the church, not the garden tomb, there's a little pillar. You know, if you look at medieval world maps, they'll picture that pillar. Because that was the center of the earth. It's interesting that when Jesus rose from the dead, the Christian world, the Western, well, all the Christian world from that point on, as history developed, viewed that as the center of the world. The question is, where is the center of the world? You can understand, you can find these replicas of these old maps, 400-500 years old, 700 years old, and you'll see that little point, and you go there and it's still there. But now Babylon's the center of the world. Now, and the tree, contemporary literature, that is literature of that age, commonly referred to, should read, Mesopotamian rulers as trees. This was common imagery, the cuneiform records. Now, one of the reasons is that in the Mesopotamian world, especially the southern Mesopotamian valley, large trees were very rare. One of the first things that the Babylonians did when they raided the western borders was they cut down the trees and take them home. They did not have building wood. That area does not grow large trees. Partly because it's so dry, partly because it's like there's some parts of America that don't grow large trees, even though it has enough water. As you know, some parts of the country, if there's a pan, it's called, of a clay pan below the level of the ground, that roots will not penetrate through that. And therefore, large trees, which had to put down deep roots, will not grow. They grow smaller trees, smaller bushes. And much of the world is like that. There's parts of the country like that. There are parts of the country, like the Dakotas, where if you don't plant a large tree, you have to dig down through that pan and get the roots below it before it'll grow. Well, anyway, the point is, and because trees were rare, large trees, they became a symbol of sustenance, of power. Because what does a tree do? A tree provides shade. And boy, that was great. You know, this is one of the interesting things. I wish I had time to develop all these things. Shade. You know, shade is very important to you guys. If you think up on a farm like I did, you know how important shade is. I remember David said that God is like, we have a song. There's the one of the songs. Beneath the cross of Jesus, I fain would take my stand. The shadow of a mighty cross, of a mighty rock. Within a weary land, that phrase causes the shadow of a mighty rock within a weary land. It's based on David referred to God as he was a mighty rock that cast a shadow and I could cool off in the shade. And to the ancients who lived lives where there was no air conditioning, it was hot, and to go in the shade, in the fine shade, especially in the Mesopotamian Valley. You had to build your own shade. And boy, if there was ever a large tree, it was a precious thing. And so you see the image, why they would create that imagery? For there to be a large tree. A king was to be the one who protected, who gave sustenance. And so he was like a large tree. Why? It would provide shade. It would provide fruit. The birds would come and nest in it. And so what I'm saying, so the tree as protector, sustainer, rewarder. So what God is speaking to Nebuchadnezzar in a language he would understand, in an apocalyptic or symbolic language he would understand, the large tree. Any questions on that? It's quite historical. Now, look at verses 11 and 12, a point to that. The tree grew large, its foliage was beautiful, and Look at verse, the beast of the field found shade. Well, then this watcher, a holy one, comes along. Who is it? Probably an angel. We don't know. And shouts a command. Cut down the tree. Let the tree be cut down in Aramaic, technically. But leave the stump, indicating why. Whoever is represented by this tree is not going to be killed. But he's going to be cut down. The kingship of Nebuchadnezzar was not eradicated. Now the band of iron put around it, probably connected with the madness that is coming. It prophesies. Like you would put a collar around an animal. Now we're going to talk about that later. But the band of iron, he's going to come like an animal to teach him humility. The band of iron probably symbols that we don't really know. Nebuchadnezzar descends to the level of an animal. Let his mind be changed to that of a beast. He wanders around. He's drenched with the dew of heaven. Bohat, he means cow. It's the word for ox, the Greek word for ox. To become like a wolf or become like an ox. Where it didn't happen all the time. It was a well-known occurrence where a man would become like an animal. Many people are insane today if they did not have care. They were just put out, would become like that. The nails would grow long, the beard, and I said the wolf people, understand, people who were insane would just, what are you going to do with them? You want to kill them. And often they would contain them. Now, it probably Nebuchadnezzar, it says he seemed to be put out in the wilderness. He was probably in one of the royal animal parks or something, somewhere in the palace grounds. He was probably kept in the palace grounds, perhaps walled in for his, because still a king. But what happens to a person like that? They become, they don't shave, man, and the hair grows, their nails grow, they become like an animal. The wolf man myth. What is the wolf man myth? When does the wolf man turn into a wolf? And the ancient, the moon, of course, in the ancient world was connected, in the superstition of the ancient world, very common. The moon was connected with madness. The moon, you ever heard of moon man? What does the word lunatic mean? Lunar is the word for moon. A lunatic that came into our language because when the moon comes full, all the weirdos get weirder. And because of this two myths came together, the myth that the moon drives you crazy, and the fact that people often were insane simply because people didn't want to do it. They would just try to contain them, and they would become animalistic if they weren't in the right mind. Came together, the wolf man myth. Well, you learned something. So Nebuchadnezzar was the original wolf man. No, that is what it's called. Now, how long was he like this? Until seven periods of time pass over him. Here are the possibilities. It could 7 years. Does he mean 7 years? Probably not. Why? It's doubtful that Nebuchadnezzar could have retained his throne and been insane for 7 years. Are these seven astrological periods? How many signs? And in ancient, the Babylonians went by the signs of the zodiac. How many periods are there in the zodiac in a year? How many signs? Come on. 12. Therefore, it would have been about 7 months. In other words, is he saying seven of the 12 signs of the zodiac? I think that's a possibility. Y'all understand that? Okay. Moving quickly. It could be a long, indefinite period of time. Or does the number seven indicate divine intervention and completeness, which is a possibility? That is, until God's ready, until God's purpose is fulfilled, seven periods of time. That may be kind of strange. I don't really know. But to the Orient, to the Western mind, that seems sounds strange. To the Oriental mind, maybe not so strange. Those are the possibilities. Pay your money and take your choice. Now, what was the more important? What was the lesson to be learned? I think he was probably that way less than a year, a few months. What was the lesson to be learned? Verse 17: that God is the ruler, not man, and. Was there a council in heaven? Let his mind be changed from that to a man. We'll talk about that later. I'll refer to 1 Kings. Well, let's leave that because our time is getting away from us. So Daniel, verses 19 through 27, Daniel interprets the dream. And here's the sermon. Then Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar tells after the fact, was appalled for a while as his thoughts alarmed him after the king told him his dream. The king responded and said, Belteshazzar, don't let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. But did Daniel really love Nebuchadnezzar that much? That he would just hate to tell him? Probably not. But in those days, when the tradition was, if a messenger brought you bad news, you killed the messenger. And if a prophet gave you a message you didn't like, you killed the prophet. You didn't just casually tell the king he's going to be nutting a fruitcake for a long time. That this great proud man is going to be like an animal. And so he says, I think this is not personal concern. This is wise protocol. He says, he's going to give him the bad news. Oh, king, I wish this was for your enemies, not for you. He's gilding the lily. He's preparing the way for himself. The tree that you saw, which became large and grew strong, whose height reached to the sky, and was visible to all the earth, and whose foliage was beautiful, foliage was beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in which it was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the sky lodged, it's you, O king. For you have become great and grown strong. Your majesty has become great, like the tree, you see, and reached to the sky, your dominion to the end of the earth, and the tree covered the whole earth in the vision. In that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, yet let leave the stump with its roots in the ground, with a band of iron and bronze around it, and the new grass of the field, and let it be drenched with the dew of heaven, let him share with the beasts of the field until seven periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. This is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord and king, that you be driven away from mankind, that your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven, and seven periods of time will pass over you until you recognize, here's the point, this is the key verse, key statement. Until you recognize what? That the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever you wish. And in that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break now away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. Better repent. He was cruel, pagan. This is your chance. Did he learn the lesson? Doesn't seem to be that kind of fellow. He's got my vote for the hardest-headed man that ever lived. Of all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king, that is, all that follows. 12 months later, time heals all wounds. Wounds all heals. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. Now, here is why I think this is the original one. The king reflected and said, is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and the glory of my majesty? Who built that? The original one did. Nebuchadnezzar the Great. Now, it doesn't prove it. It may be that we have a very arrogant man who inherited this, but who took credit for it. That was not uncommon. Often, kings took credit for what their predecessors had done. So it may not be the original one. It may just be a sign of the unspeakable arrogance of the man. While the word was in the king's mouth, even while he's, look, this is dramatic. While he's saying this, looking out over Babylon and saying, what a good boy am I. Look at all that I've done. Aren't I something? Who's the biggest dog around? Same one. While the word was in the king's mouth, even while he's saying this, the voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you. God says, I tried to tell you. Now you've done it. Daniel told you to repent, but you wouldn't do it. And you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You will be given grass to eat like the meat. And he repeats this. Verse 33. Immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. Immediately, that night, right then, he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. He spent whatever time it was living like an animal. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my reason returned to me. God let him up. And I bless the Most High God and praise and honor him forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion. Now, the picture here at the bottom of 17, Nebuchadnezzar's pride, this is an artist's conception of this boasting king, whether he built it or his ancestors built it. Anyway, lifts his eyes and he says, and bless the Most High, the God of Daniel, God of Israel, and praise and honor him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. But he does according to his will in the host of heaven, that means in the stars, and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand. He learned that, didn't he? And or say to him, what hast thou done? Nobody's going to call God to account. Nobody can stay his hand. At that time, Nebuchadnezzar tells us, my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. My counselors and my nobles began seeking me out, so I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are true, and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. And I would say it, close this out. Any questions on the meaning of the text in the time he has available to us? I would say to close out our study that verse 37 would not be a bad devotional verse for each of us. If any of us doesn't think more of himself than we ought to think, you don't have to be a king of Babylon to be arrogant. Pride, you know, talk about the deadly sins, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. We're all too proud, aren't we? And we need to learn the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learned. And we know, do we not, that God, while this is an extreme case and an unusual occasion and situation, is it not true that God sometimes reduces us? Like the old saying is, sometimes God has to put a man flat on his back before the man will look up. And God does that. The book of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 11 says, concerning the Lord's Supper, if we don't, and this is a paraphrase, the teaching is, if we don't judge ourselves, God may have to do it for us. When we come to the Lord's Supper, this is what God says to us, 1 Corinthians 11. You see this sin? You want to take care of it? You want me to? I said to my children sometimes, you raise your kids, and they'll be doing something that's not acceptable. And I've said it to my kids, still do. Look, this is going to be taken care of. You can take care of it. God loves us enough sometimes to say it to us. We look over our own bad ones and say, my, look at what I've done. Look at my life. Aren't I something? Isn't God lucky to have me on his side? Isn't heaven blessed that I was born? Are we heaven? Things we hang on to arrogantly. God says to them, our sins that we stubbornly refuse to repent of. God says to us, look, you want to take care of this? You want me to? And so let's not act as if this is nothing but ancient history. Because the God who made Nebuchadnezzar roam the palace gardens as an animal, is the God who will deal with us and our arrogance. We're dismissed. Good to have a guest with us today. Ron, have you been here before, sir?
This is my youngest brother. He just got back from Indiana.
Indiana!
That's a good place to be.
Indiana!
Yeah, I know what it is.
Because I wish I'd known you were coming. I'd had you bring some good Southern Indiana dirt and a Mason fruit jar. I put that on my cereal.
It's good.
I'm from down in Southern Indiana. That's good.